Whether I'm worried about hosting or just giving that perfect gift, creating a delicious holiday for my loved ones is super important to me. From effortless holiday hostings to unforgettable gifts, Omaha Steaks delivers the world's best steak experience. They've always been super convenient in giving me the most high-quality steaks I could ask for, whether for myself or a loved one. Omaha Steaks offers unrivaled quality and variety, and every bite is backed by their 100% guarantee. Save big on gourmet gifts and more holiday favorites with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com, and for an extra $35 off, use code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code YUM. Go to omahasteaks.com and use code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details. A big thanks to our advertiser, Omaha Steaks.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Chapter 16 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 16. Susan Bellows awoke suddenly and completely. She lay in bed with her eyes closed, dizzy from the sleeping pills, trying to remember what she had been dreaming. Dreams were very important. Her analyst in New York was always interested in her dreams, and Susan faithfully jotted down the details whenever she could remember them. This time it seemed to her that a deep, distant voice had been calling her name. What else? Something unpleasant. Her dreams were usually unpleasant. Men flowed into animals. Landscapes became alive and threatening. There was no escape from the Freudian goblins, the witches and warlocks, the shape-changers with whom she lived or from whom she fled, for one-third of every 24 hours. 8 hours a day were spent in a country of black enchantment and supernatural menace. The analyst hadn't changed that. Quite the contrary, he had gloried in it, practically gloated over it. The dreams were important. They were a step past suppression. She sometimes suspected that he was crazy. Suppression was so much easier to live with. It was unfashionable but cozy. If you could suppress, then perhaps you wouldn't have to spend a third of your time walking across a landscape that had never existed, the victim of a magic that had never taken place. She opened her eyes, sensing at the same time the emptiness of the bed beside her.
"Dane," she called sharply, "where are you?"
"Right over here." He was standing in front of the bathroom mirror, knotting his tie.
"What's wrong? Has anything happened?"
"I just got a phone call from CIA.
"And I didn't hear it?"
"You didn't hear a thing. The thief has been seen in Vienna." She got out of bed, the nightgown falling away from her shoulders. Dane finished knotting his tie. She slipped on a dressing gown, trying to restrain a shudder. The waking up afterward was always bad, especially if the man was dressed.
"Vienna?"
she said. "That's the report."
"Are they sure it's the right man?"
"No, but the description checks. I think it's worth looking into."
"Just a minute," Susan said. "I'm going with you."
"You don't have to. The man was seen stealing a purse, but the police weren't able to capture him. If they do pick him up, I could send for you."
"What makes you think I'd come? I want to go to Vienna now."
"All right," Dane said. His tone was casual, but his features were cold in the morning light, and she thought she could detect a self-conscious stiffness in his movements. Even his voice sounded unnatural. Men always liked to act as though nothing had happened, but they were never quite able to bring it off. She dressed quickly. When she was ready, just before they left the room, she touched Dane on the hand.
"Steve, do you despise me?"
Dane was about to laugh, but he checked himself when he saw that she was perfectly serious.
"Of course I don't. Isn't that obvious?"
She hated herself for asking. These morning quizzes were embarrassing. They were stereotyped and grotesque. But she couldn't stop herself. The words, like the syllables of an outworn and meaningless incantation, poured out.
"Are you sure? Are you really sure? The way I threw myself at you?"
"I'd call that mutual."
"But you must have ideas about women who do that. Haven't you? Honestly, now, haven't you?
Susan, I swear to you. She heard Dane say all the proper things. He held her in his arms and he kissed her. For a moment, she realized that he was shy beneath his poise, genuinely fond of her, and uncertain of himself when he entered the jungle of human emotions. But that meant nothing against the driving force of her own anxiety. She listened to the reassuring words, but they had no effect on her. The incantation always failed. She summoned all her willpower and pushed him away.
I'm ready to go now.
Are you sure you feel all right?
Of course. Why shouldn't I?
Dane didn't answer. Only analysts, who understood everything and felt nothing, tried to answer that question. She walked with him out the door. Dane spent the rest of the day at CIA headquarters. He checked out reports of the thief being sighted in Rome, Athens, and Beirut, and decided that the Vienna report was the most reliable. He left a message for Colonel Nestor, found that there was no night flight to Austria, and booked two seats on the Arlberg Orient Express. The train left at 2:20 in the morning. They had time for a leisurely dinner and a movie. By the time they left for the Gare de l'Est, the waiters were taking in the chairs from the sidewalk cafes, and the Paris streets were almost deserted. At the station, there was plenty of activity. It was just as Susan had remembered it. A huge gray structure with tobacco booths and souvenir shops stretching away into an infinity of covered distance. At any hour of the day or night, people hurried through this vast, multi-leveled cavern to the tall iron gates, behind which were the trains, the romantic ones with names like Arlberg Orient or Trino del Sol. The common ones without any name, only a destination. They had nearly half an hour to wait before the train took on passengers, so they walked to the waiting room past a troop of shivering German Boy Scouts in khaki shorts. In the waiting room, they sat down opposite a bearded young man who slept on his lumpy knapsack. Beside him was a well-dressed man in his 50s, a rolled umbrella across his knees, reading a day-old express. An attendant shuffled slowly across the room, sweeping the cigarette butts and candy wrappers. Gray tobacco smoke coiled around the brown benches. Outside, Susan could hear the hiss and grunt of a steam train. From a far corner of the station, a loudspeaker voice grumbled incomprehensible words, speaking its own strange amplifier language. She felt warm and sleepy, very comfortable beside Dane, not at all apprehensive. She studied the people around her with only slight interest. They were crumpled on the hard benches, suspended between waking and sleeping, listlessly fighting fatigue with cigarettes and newspapers, or yielding to it and sleeping on the straight-backed wooden benches like travelers at night anywhere in the world. The room was filled with sleep, gray with it, and it was intensified by the short, steady scrape of the attendant's broom across the stone floor. She could find hypnotism anywhere, in the tick of the wall clock, the drifting smoke shapes, the dray scrape of a broom. The attendant moved past her, angular in a faded blue uniform, black leather cap pulled down hard over his closed face. He was a careless sweeper. Bits of paper and crushed cigarette packs escaped the sides of his broom. He ignored them. He seemed to be shoveling a trail rather than sweeping a floor. He moved with short steps, and then she saw that his broom caught nothing at all. He glanced at her and looked quickly down again. That was like the slow, almost imperceptible beginning of a nightmare. The first suggestion that something in the normal surroundings had changed. It was a man in a sweeper's blue uniform and black leather cap who moved across the room like a puppet, but who only pretended to sweep. She had thought that Dane was asleep, but when she turned to him, she saw that his eyes were hard and brilliantly awake. She touched his arm, and Dane nodded. "Yes, I see it. Just pretend you don't notice." That made the sense of nightmare complete. Pretend you don't notice. Perhaps it will go away. But it never did. The act of observation, no matter how subtly done, always sets the mechanism into motion. Now, as she watched, the old gentleman across from her folded his newspaper with a well-practiced air. His umbrella rested across his knees, the ferrule pointed at Dane. He folded and refolded his newspaper into a square he could hold with one hand. The other hand rested lightly on the handle of his umbrella. She had heard about things like knife canes and single-shot umbrellas. But he looked so ordinary with his brown tweed suit and knit tie, his tufted gray eyebrows above a mild, empty face. Perhaps he was ordinary. Some of them in the waiting room had to be ordinary. The man in the faded blue uniform finished doing his imitation of a sweeper and leaned against his broom near the door. The bearded young man continued to sleep on his lumpy knapsack, his face in repose.
"Are you sure?" she murmured to Dane.
"Yes."
"Is it the old man with the umbrella?"
"He's one of them."
"Who else?"
"The sweeper, and the man in the blue raincoat. Probably others I haven't spotted." The man in the blue raincoat was short and stocky, dark-jowled, villainous-looking. He sat at the end of a bench between them and the door. She should have picked him out immediately. The wall clock ticked, and the minute hand jerked forward. It was 15 minutes to train time. No one left the waiting room. Susan and Dane continued their whispered conversation.
"You're sure they're after us?"
"Yes. I know two of their faces from the files." He had an advantage over her. He had seen those faces before, so for Dane it wasn't a nightmare.
"But why?"
"They think you're the only person who can make a positive identification of the thief. They don't want us to find him. They want to do that themselves."
"But can't we do anything?"
"Not yet." The black edge of the clock's minute hand sheared off another 2 minutes. Two old ladies gathered up their net bags and left the waiting room. The bearded young man awoke to the sound of some internal alarm clock, rubbing his face and picked up his knapsack. He sat and adjusted the straps, not moving from his seat. So he was also probably one of them. "In another 2 minutes," Dane said, "we'll leave here and go to the train."
"But what about them?"
"That's probably what they want us to do." She wondered if Dane had a plan. His face gave away nothing. He sat in his own silence, sleepy-eyed, disinterested, his hands jammed into his pockets. The old gentleman refolded his newspaper, and now the umbrella was pointed at Susan. Abruptly, the man in the blue raincoat left the waiting room. The attendant leaned his broom against the wall and tugged his cap down harder on his head. The bearded young man glanced at the wall clock and checked it against his wristwatch. The clock gulped 2 minutes. "All right," Dane said. "We're going now. Don't panic. When you get away from here, go straight to Colonel Nestor at Army Intelligence. Tell him everything you know and ask him to relay it to Central Intelligence."
Am I going to get away?"
"Of course."
"And you?"
"I'll meet you at Nestor's office," Dane said. "We may have to split up." Dane stood up and helped her to her feet. The old gentleman cleared his throat explosively and stood up. Dane and Susan walked out of the waiting room. The bearded young man finished adjusting his straps, swung the knapsack over his shoulder, and followed them. One behind and one ahead. They heard the clatter of the attendant's broom. He, too, was walking behind them. At the far end of the station, she could see the troop of German Boy Scouts boarding a train. A scattering of people hurried back and forth. She and Dane walked with their retinue toward the Arlberg Orient Express, and suddenly, horribly, Susan knew they would never be allowed to board it. They would be killed on the platform where the crowd was thinnest by men who would drift back into the station and be gone before the police could be found and brought to the scene of the crime. As she passed the iron gates, it seemed to her that this death in the gray morning hours of a Paris train station must have been ordained. The people around her, old man, bearded man, uniformed man, blue raincoat man, were figures out of a morality play, representing nothing. This was the real morality play they were performing under the blind eyes of the sooted train windows, a play without reason and without end, in which murder marked nothing more than a brief intermission. Potential players passed, a train man with high cap and oil can, two fat men with briefcases, a hunter with his rifle and a cloth bag slung over his shoulder. She glanced hopefully at the hunter, but Dane, one hand on her arm, urged her forward. The other actors weren't cued in. They moved to the smoky wings. Dane and Susan walked down the platform past rows of second-class cars. The platform was deserted now, except for their own special group. Ahead, she could see the last cars of the train, and past them, the hazy black night sky. The others saw the sky, too. They edged in like herding sheepdogs. Their actions were more obvious now, and therefore less horrible. Dane whispered, "When the break comes, run as fast as you can."
"Break? What break?"
He didn't answer. They reached an open first-class car and started to pass it. Abruptly, Dane swung around and she felt his hands on her wrist. She was being lifted. She was falling. Dane had thrown her up the steps into the vestibule of the train. She landed on her hands and knees, stood up quickly, and looked back. Dane, tall and shadowy in gray smoke, had turned and clutched the man in the blue raincoat and the old gentleman with the umbrella. The attendant was shouting something and trying to get past the group, which blocked the entrance to the train. The bearded young man had come around Dane's side. He was clubbing him with something shiny in his fist, swinging as methodically as a man driving nails. She ran across the vestibule and out the other side of the train. For a moment she hesitated, looking up and down the tracks. Then, hearing footsteps behind her, she plunged toward the open night sky. She ran for a long time, ran and fell and ran again. When she couldn't run any longer, she hid behind a row of diesel barrels. She stayed there for the rest of the night. For a while she heard footsteps, and once a flashlight probed past her, almost catching the edge of her skirt before it moved on. But they didn't find her. Later she must have dozed off, for after sunrise a French railway detective almost stepped on her. After sufficient explanation, he took her to U.S. Army Intelligence. She had barely enough strength to report what had happened. The railway detective could not affirm or deny her statement. To the best of his knowledge, there had been no disturbance in the station last night. The Arlberg Orient had left on schedule. The only evidence was her torn and dirty clothing and her scraped legs. That, and the fact that Dane still had not reported. End of chapter 16. Chapter 17 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 17. When Dane recovered consciousness, he found that he was stretched out on a couch in a dark, dusty room. The room was windowless except for a barred skylight in the sloping ceiling 20 feet above his head. There was a tender lump behind his right ear and another above his forehead. A branched stream of blood had dried on his temple and cheek. He was very thirsty, and his head ached. There were raw welts on his wrists and ankles, showing that, until recently, he had been tied or wired. He stretched his neck back, easing the trip hammer in his skull. He flexed his numb fingers. This looked as though it was going to be a bad time. He was as ready for it as an intelligent man could be. That meant not ready at all. Hope played very little part in his makeup. If he were inclined toward despair, he would have given up the game long ago at the sight of history ponderously serving the side he didn't work for. He was held to his profession by cold intellectual conviction, but it was the strongest bond he could have. There were no revelations in store for him, no man-made wonders to behold and worship. He had seen the people's democracies of the East. Unlike some of his colleagues, he hadn't rejected them instantly and emotionally out of hand. Instead, he had examined them with an interest that bordered on political heresy. He had to consider himself a free agent. The expression of political freedom for Dane had been to inspect as honestly as he could the doctrines of his country's enemies. For him to have served in any other way would, he felt, have been robotic. And when he had finished, it was with a great relief that he chose freely to serve the political system of his own country. He liked to think that, had the circumstances called for it, he would have had the courage to change sides. But he was glad past all expression that what he had found in communist theory and practice was inalterably opposed to everything he wanted for himself and for others. The essence of his being lay in a sense of individualism that bordered on anarchy. Mass coercion and indoctrination anywhere seemed to him a perversion of more than the mind. It felt like a maniacal use of the very earth upon which men existed in such individual and irremediable profusion. He had made up his mind, as long as he could think, he would be the man he was serving the cause he served. When he could no longer think, he would no longer be Dane. He worked without exultation, but with conviction, for the forces he believed least bad. This served as his meager political philosophy. It suited his temperament, which was pragmatic rather than idealistic. It fitted the man who was a dissenter rather than an affirmer. He was radically moderate, a man who killed without believing in the necessity of murder, who acted without feeling that any individual action would make a difference, who held himself responsible for anything he had done or had omitted to do, and who expected to pay for any involuntary abuses of responsibility. During the years between OSS and the present, Dane had become a political man, inevitably and to his regret. He had viewed his own evolution with the deepest suspicion. He felt that too much of human importance had become merely accessory to him. He suspected a lessening of himself in the very act of trying to serve humanity rather than humans. It was suspect, like trying to serve God or nature. It hinted at a barrenness that could only partially be explained by natural austerity, a coldness that no political necessity could obliterate. He felt that he was less than he should be, and that his choice of work masked a man who had failed as a human. This view of himself was not necessarily shared by others. Some, in fact, would quite vehemently oppose it. But Dane believed it, and for him that made it true. He knew that he was not alone. He belonged to that terrible brotherhood whose best friends were machines or relics or dogmas, whose passion was for abstractions removed as far as possible from the soil which had given them birth, whose children screamed in the stratosphere or were mute in heaven. Dane could accept this state of affairs and live by it, but he didn't have to like it. Even more important, he didn't have to wish it on others. Zetner questioned him several times during the next 24 hours. Zetner placed Dane as a detached and uncomfortable intellectual serving a cause without real conviction. There were arguments to use with such men, and Zetner used them. He considered it possible that with the proper reorientation, Dane could be brought around to accept a new set of conclusions about the nature and function of society. From these conclusions, a new basis for action could be laid. And Dane, alive and serving the proper cause, was infinitely more valuable than... And Dane, alive and serving the proper cause, was infinitely more valuable than a dead and recalcitrant Dane. Zetner pursued his goal in a textbook manner. Dane was nothing more than a puzzle to be solved, a tangle to be straightened, a set of reflexes to be conditioned. But the textbooks, coming into contact with stubborn and contradictory life, failed utterly. Dane had his own arguments, which Zetner considered irrational, but which tended to insulate the man from the force of any proselytizing religion. No fire burned in Dane's soul at the thought of the masses. He was indifferent to the sacred course of history. Still, Dane and Zetner had one quality in common, which they shared almost gratefully when the obligatory political discussions were out of the way. They both liked to talk shop. Dane was very interested in the manner in which Zetner had transported him from a Paris train station to this present location, which, he learned, was on the outskirts of Vienna. Zetner was only too happy to tell him. Abstract social theory had never really been his strong point. Zetner expanded visibly as he explained the elaborate plan, the alternatives, the stage setting. He brought out maps and showed how he had placed men here and here, automobiles here and here. Leaving Paris had been simple. Crossing the frontier into Germany and then into Austria had been a more complicated matter. The correct border posts had to be chosen, of course. After that, Zetner had relied on his bookish understanding of human nature. Although Dane hadn't known it at the time, he had been wired and gagged and put in the trunk of a car. The car had been driven by three attractive French girls, presumably on vacation. There had been no difficulties at the frontiers, and Dane applauded the plan. When Zetner left the room for the last time, he felt a little sorry that a man as good as this had to be killed after all possible information had been extracted from him. Bardief entered later, smiling and mournful, bearing a bottle of wine and a box of cigars. They had met once before at the end of the Second World War when Bardief was an infantry major and Dane a captain in OSS. It had been at an embassy party in Berlin, and they had exchanged no more than four sentences. Since then they had heard of each other through Secret Service papers and intelligence reports. Their brief meeting had been enough to put flesh on the bare facts noted in the dossiers. They sat for a while in companionable silence. Then Bardief, examining the glowing tip of his cigar, asked Dane what he thought of Zetner. "He's very young," Bardief nodded. "And willful." Bardief poured out two more glasses of wine. Dane said, "You must find him an uncomfortable sort of colleague." Bardief shrugged, his lips turned down. A delicate question hung in the air. Dane voiced it. "Bardief, will you let me go?"
"That would be quite impossible," Bardief said in a horse trader's voice.
"It would be eminently practical."
"Why?"
"Because," Dane said, "I would promise to kill Zetner for you."
"My friend, you must be out of your mind. Kill Zetner? What on earth for?"
"In order to save your life, and of course mine." The question was voiced now, but unacknowledged. Bardief said,
"Dane, the wine has gone to your head. You're talking the sheerest nonsense. Why would I want to see my friend Zetner killed?"
My information is that your chief has been transferred to the Afghanistan border. That leaves you, Bardeef, like a hand without an arm. Ah, Bardeef sighed. The winds of policy. You've survived many changes of policy. How have you managed to do it in the past? Bardeef looked thoughtfully at his hands. Exactly, Dane said. Are you going to refuse a useful instrument when it comes within reach? Quarrels in the family are our own business. It's your head, Dane said. They sat again in silence. After a while, Bardeef said, I am not a traitor. I do not consider you one. The question doesn't arise. If you don't consider me a traitor, what makes you think I would perform a traitorous action? Bardeef asked it solemnly, but his eyes were shining. This is my line of reasoning, Dane said. Your sponsor is out of favor. Therefore, you are out of favor. Your political position is now considered wrong.
Temporarily.
Yes, but you want to live temporarily. Zetner and his friends will sweep clean as soon as they are consolidated. The very best you could hope for is a 20-year sentence in a penal colony. I might be sent to one of the Asiatic cities as an administrator. Now, that seems quite unlikely. Go on, Bardeef said. I don't question your patriotism, Dane said. In fact, I'm relying on it. Who, in your opinion, is better fitted to serve your country, you or Zetner?
I am in favor of myself.
Then you have already decided upon your course of action.
Not so fast, Bardeef said. What would it gain me if someone killed Zetner?
That would not change policy. It would buy time, and you know how valuable time is. Policies change.
Not for me, Bardeef said. Not when I am asked why I let the prisoner Dane escape.
You will not let me escape. Zetner will. After all, he's in charge at present. The guards are his, and the responsibility is also his. Any mistake will be considered his own fault.
What will Zetner's mistake be?
A sin of pride. He has neglected to have me searched thoroughly.
That was certainly a mistake, Bardeef said, grinning openly. Would you require much equipment to effect an escape?
Very little.
Your chances would still be slight. We are on an estate about 20 miles from Vienna. There are guards, dogs, and an electrified wire fence.
Well, that's all right. Bardeef stood up, looking down at Dane. He said,
Do you really know what you're doing? I can be more dangerous than all the Zetners in the world.
I believe that, Dane said, but I'll stand a better chance against you alive.
You'll lose.
We'll see, Dane said. For the moment, let's concentrate on staying alive.
Both of us. That does seem to be the primary condition, Bardeef said.
End of chapter 17. Chapter 18 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 18. Late in the evening, Zetner received good news. The thief had made contact with a minor official of a Soviet trade delegation in Vienna. The official, fortunately, had been briefed on this possibility. Following orders, he had asked for a chance to speak to his superiors and had agreed at once to the thief's terms for the next meeting. The official had then gone to his embassy, and the embassy had sent him to Zetner. After a detailed questioning, Zetner decided that the matter sounded genuine. The man who had contacted the trade official had obviously not been the thief himself. He was a large, shambling man, the official had said, red-faced, dull-witted, not very steady on his feet, obviously a heavy drinker, probably a local petty criminal whom the thief had hired to act as a contact man. The asking price for the papers was the ridiculously low sum of $5,000. Zetner agreed to this at once. The thief could ask for $1,000,000 or $100,000. It would not be paid. There was no necessity of doing so, since the thief's organization was quite apparently impromptu and easily traced. Now that a contact had been made, the papers could be regained without spending a cent. Zetner never spent money unnecessarily, but there was a more important issue involved than the expenditure of $5,000. Zetner had suffered a loss of face because of the disruption of his original plan. This could be corrected now. The thief probably thought he was safe. He would soon find out how difficult security really was. Although the next meeting was set for tomorrow noon, Agents had already found the contact man drinking his wages in a bar near Esterhazy Square. They were keeping him under surveillance, but leaving him strictly alone. Unless he was much cleverer than he looked, he would lead them to the man who had the papers. Zettner explained all this to Bardeef, sitting in the big front room of the lodge with a glass of soda water beside him. Bardeef agreed that the plan seemed excellent. In a burst of generosity, Zettner began to explain the detailed workings of the scheme. He was interrupted by the furious barking of the Dobermans outside the lodge. At the same time, a guard hurried into the room to announce that the prisoner was no longer in his room. Zettner reacted quickly. He ordered all the estate lights on and sent the guards out with orders to shoot the man on sight. He threw a switch which electrified the fence around the estate. Then he and Bardeef went to examine the prisoner's room. They found that Dane had escaped with ridiculous ease. He had turned the couch on its end, propped it against the wall, and used it as a ladder. With some sort of tool, he had broken the lock on the barred skylight. He had cut the glass with another tool and had gone out over the roof. There he had knocked out a guard and lowered himself to the ground with a slim nylon cord which was still fastened to a chimney. "A fantastic business," Bardeef said when they had returned to the front room. "How do you suppose he procured the tools?" "I don't understand it," Zettner said. "He couldn't have had them on his person," Bardeef said in a tone of obvious disbelief. Zettner didn't answer. His marble skin took on a slight rosy flush. "No, no," Bardeef said. "That would be quite impossible. You had him searched, of course." "Everything was so rushed. There seemed no necessity." Bardeef's expression was incredulous. "You did not have him searched? My dear Zettner." "It doesn't matter," Zettner said. "He can't escape from the estate."
"But not to search a man like that."
"I tell you, it doesn't matter. We will recapture Dane within the hour."
"For all we know," Bardeef said thoughtfully, "he may have a pistol."
"No, he would have used it earlier."
"Who knows what a man like that would do? I think we must assume he is armed."
Zettner's lips tightened. He opened a drawer and took out an automatic. "I'd better direct this hunt personally. Are you coming?"
"Of course," Bardeef said. "I was simply waiting for you."
Klaus knew that it was a vicious circle. Only alcohol in massive doses had a real effect on him, and he never had enough money for a massive dose. Even tonight, after performing a discreet and dangerous job, he didn't have enough money to achieve intoxication. They had paid stingily, that little dark foreigner and his woman. Just enough money to bring on a mild haze, not enough to turn the world into the joyous place God meant it to be. He ordered another muscatel, noting with regret that it would have to be his last. Carl the bartender would sell him drinks even if he lay retching on the floor, but he would not extend one shilling in credit. Still, Carl was better than most. Carl's bar was a place for serious drinking, and the prices were low. Neither Carl nor the patrons gave a damn who you were or what you did. Even foreigners liked to come here, like those three over in the corner. They'd been drinking steadily all evening, ever since he had come in. They'd been drinking bottled beer and talking very little. Foreigners were strange. Like the little man who had hired him. That man had made two promises. $500 American if he did his work right, and an absolutely certain death if he tried any tricks like running away with the money. Hired killers were watching, the foreigner had said. A gunman on a rooftop or in a car would kill him if he didn't obey orders exactly. That was what the foreigner, speaking through his blonde woman, had said. And then they had both stared at him to see how he would take it. Well, it was all right with him. He wasn't ambitious. $500 was nice pay for 2 days' work as a messenger. He had told them that, and perhaps they had believed him. Whether they did or not, Klaus knew that he would follow orders exactly. That dark, nervous little foreigner looked as though he would hunt a man to the ends of the earth if he wanted revenge. $500. It was a very good sum of money. He would be smart. He would let his sister keep it for him. He would tell her, "Give me this a little at a time." Of course, she might cheat him. Or worse yet, she might force him into a business. Perhaps he should put his money into a bank. He fell into a fantasy over his empty glass. He imagined a special tavern reserved only for drinkers like himself. With absolute honesty, it would administer the funds possessed by drinkers, and it would advance them unlimited credit. This tavern would be clean and pleasant, its prices would be lower than Carl's, and it would have free bedrooms for the use of the patrons. In fact, a man would never have to leave. This tavern would take care of drinkers and protect them from the cold, sober and scrupulous jackals who preyed on a man's enjoyment. Carl the bartender tapped him on the shoulder and looked questioningly at his glass. Carl always knew how much money a man had in his pocket. He was a lean and sober jackal who never touched a drop, who could tell from the set of your shoulders when you had finished your last drink of the night. No dreaming over empty glasses here. Come back tomorrow with money. Klaus left, nodding a polite good night to Carl. The foreigners were leaving too. In fact, they were out the door before him. Outside, one of them waved goodbye to his friends and turned down a side street. The others were walking in Klaus's direction on the opposite side of the road. They were probably looking for a place with girls. Klaus's steps were not quite certain. He walked in a moist dream, thinking of his foundation, wondering how he could keep his $500 safe but within easy reach. Soon he was on Argentinier Strauss, and in another 10 minutes he had reached his destination. The blonde woman was waiting for him in a room on the third floor of a decayed building.
"I saw the Soviet official today," Klaus said. "He has agreed to everything you asked." "Did anyone follow you here?" "Certainly not." "Are you sure?" "As I told you before, no man living can follow me through the streets of Vienna if I don't want to be followed."
The guarded expression on the woman's face didn't change. Klaus felt a secret embarrassment, and with it a dark tinge of resentment. It was true what he told her. The police had always been following him years ago when he worked on the black market. They had never been able to trace him to his source. That had been a long time back, of course, during the occupation. But he was as good a man now as he had ever been. The blonde woman's face relaxed a little.
"All right," she said. "I think it sounds all right. You'll come here tomorrow morning. Then you'll meet those Russians at noon."
"That's right."
"And you won't get drunk? Tomorrow is the important part."
"I promise you I won't get drunk," Carl said. "I'll go straight to my room now."
"And you'll come back here at 9 in the morning.
"Why so early? I don't have to see them until noon."
9 o'clock, the blonde woman said firmly. "We may have to change the plan or something."
"All right."
"And as soon as it's over, there'll be $500 for you."
Klaus nodded. Suddenly he thought of the foreign men. Could they have been detectives? No, probably not. They would have arrested him by now. He decided not to mention them. If the woman knew he had been careless, she might not give him the $500 American. Besides, it was her own fault. She shouldn't have given him any money yet. Everybody knew that. She went to the window and peered through the curtains. She said,
"There's no one in the street."
"Of course not."
He was safe. The foreigners must have gone away. Dane moved quickly away from the house, a shadow gliding among shadows. Floodlights went on. Their brilliant glow produced more profound patches of darkness for him to pass through. Behind him he could hear dogs barking, and there was a tramp of heavy footsteps as the guards came out of the doorway and vanished in the gloom. There were woods within 50 yards of the house, and beyond them lay the perimeter of the wire fence. He reached the margin of the woods just as the first Doberman reached him. He stopped, taking aim with the Beretta which Bardif had given him. Then he changed his mind and shoved the gun into his belt. The sound of a shot would bring the guards directly to him. He could never expect to get over the fence in time. The dog came for him, a black streak against gray shadow. Dane moved around a tree to break the speed of the dog's charge. Once, long ago, he had learned about the habits of killer dogs. He hoped he would remember the lessons now. The Doberman spun around and leaped. Dane leaned back against the tree and lashed out with both feet, catching the dog in mid-flight, knocking him down. Instantly, Dane threw himself on the Doberman, caught the forelegs and hind legs in his hands, and broke the dog's back over his knee. He slung the corpse over his shoulder and plunged on through the woods. Blood was trickling from his wrist, a scented path for the Doberman's mate to follow. The other Doberman reached Dane before he had covered 20 yards. She was smaller than the first and faster. A patch of moonlight illuminated her, a slim, blotchy evil streaking across the ground. Dane dumped her mate directly in front of her. That gave the dog something to think about. The Doberman slowed long enough for Dane to club her with the butt of his Beretta. A final blow at the base of the skull finished it. Carrying both corpses now, Dane trotted toward the fence. His fight hadn't gone unnoticed. That was too much to hope for. Flashlights probed the ground where he had been. Men were in the woods now, and Dane moved quickly until he reached the high fence that surrounded the estate. The fence hummed. It was about 10 feet high, composed of 6 strands of wire separated by glass insulators. It seemed to wait for him in the uncertain moonlight. The footsteps of the men were getting closer. Dane fired 2 shots at random. He shoved the Beretta back into his belt, lifted one of the dogs, and flung it across the topmost strand. The dog hung there, the wire sparked, and he could smell burning hair. Dane backed away and sprinted at the fence. He leaped, using the body of the dog as a support, and vaulted over the top wire. He landed heavily on his shoulders on the other side, lay flat, and massaged his numb arm. Men were running to the fence. They had seen the blue flash. They thought he was frying on the top wire. Dane took out the Beretta and waited. Panic-stricken flashlights swept the fence, stopping when they saw the dog. The moon broke through for a moment, and Dane was able to make out Zetner's face. Steadying the gun with both hands, he fired and knew instantly that he had missed. An answering fire from automatic weapons kicked up dirt near him. Dane backed away, crossing into a hollow. He heard the bullets flying harmlessly over his head. He was tempted to go back for another try at Zetner, but he decided against it. The way things were going, there would be plenty of opportunity to keep his promise to Bardeef. Still, he felt bad about it as he walked across gently rolling land to a dirt road. End of chapter 18. Chapter 19 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 19. Carlos lay on the bed, his hands clasped behind his neck, staring at the flaked ceiling. His body was in repose, an unwilling posture he had forced on it. He was worried. Already the Enterprise had the smell of failure about it. This matter of selling the secrets was not going right. His plan had seemed simple and effective, the very best he could devise. Now it was unsatisfactory. The pressure of events was reshaping it, forcing him to improvise. Now he knew why most men never became wealthy. There were horrors to face in the procurement of riches. Anna said,
"It's almost noon."
"I know."
"Klaus still hasn't come."
"I know that, too."
She crossed the room in 3 steps and sat down on the bed beside him. Although her expression had not changed, Carlos could tell she was frightened. He was an expert on fear. He had often been witness to it, had seen it strike as dramatically as a fever. There were many kinds and types of fear, but the kind Anna had was one of the worst. It came before there was any real danger, and sometimes it didn't end until it had destroyed the ability to think. He was annoyed by her fear, afraid that he might catch it from her. He sat up abruptly.
"Klaus is not coming. I'll have to go myself."
She shook her head vehemently.
"There's no other way," Carlos said. "We shouldn't have used Klaus at all. You can't trust a drinker. He probably passed out somewhere."
"He's probably afraid."
"Shut up," Carlos told her.
He didn't believe in naming things like that. Only a woman would do it. He had to move, to shake off the uncertainty that was settling on his mind. He bent down. From under the mattress he took the cheap cardboard briefcase he had bought the previous day. Anna reached out and took his wrist in a surprisingly strong grasp.
"Don't go,"
she said. He tried gently to pull his hand free.
"I have to do it."
"It's no good without Klaus. Wait 15 minutes more."
"He's not going to show up."
"Then don't go. Not today. Make another plan in a few days."
"No," Carlos said. "We don't have enough money to go through it all again."
"Steal some money."
He stared at her, slightly shocked.
"You said you didn't want me to steal."
"I don't care what you do. I want you to stay alive."
He shook his head angrily. Only women talked like that. A man would be ashamed. He wrenched his hand free.
"You're going?"
He nodded, and she said,
"Carlos, let me kiss you goodbye."
He shook his head. It was bad luck. He gripped her by the shoulders, squeezed her, grinned at her. After a moment, she smiled back. He looked affectionately around the room. In a queer way, it felt like a home.
"I'll be back in an hour," he said. "Don't worry."
She wanted to tell him to be very careful, but she restrained herself. Once outside, walking in the sunshine, Carlos felt better. His mood of uncertainty had passed, left behind in the gray third-floor room. He was moving. He could feel his body again. That gave him confidence. He was beginning to think that the whole thing would work out after all. But he wished that Klaus had showed up. He couldn't understand a man who had become too drunk or too frightened to collect $500 for an hour's work. There was a light knock at the door. Susan Bellows opened it and saw Dane smiling at her. Her first reaction was overwhelming relief. He was alive. She could hardly believe it. She had been so certain of his death in the ghost-filled Gare de l'Est, but here he was, talking to her, and now he was drinking a scotch and soda she had prepared for him. He told her about how he had escaped, and she found it curiously moving to watch his face, animated and boyish now. She didn't really listen to any of the details, no more than she had when Charles and his friends had talked about the war. All that sort of thing was the peculiar province of men, their mystery of mysteries. She supposed that discussions of guns and hairbreadth escapes gave them a reassurance of their masculinity. God knows Charles had needed reassurances that 100 years of war could not have supplied. She became very detached. Dane's mouth moved, his hands gestured. He affected her, and she didn't like it. Her retaliation lay in trying to see the man beneath the professional veneer. She saw a pleasant American male in his 30s, lean and sexually attractive, curiously lopsided in some ways. He had never discussed books or music with her. Presumably, he was uninterested in the arts. He seemed homeless and friendless, fitting anywhere and nowhere. Perhaps that was because men liked to become their occupations. Like her ex-husband, for example. Charles truly had a physicist's mind. Even his dreams had concerned fragments of matter and lines of force. He and several of the men in his lab had once built a machine designed to take in mathematical data and give consistently wrong answers on the basis of it. They had built the machine in their spare time. That was their idea of amusement. Dane similarly seemed to have a social life that was an exact counterpart of his business life. Lines on a map, fragments of policy, dossiers and intelligence reports, little insider jokes with the boys. Men were such idiots. Some expression on her face must have changed, for Dane asked her what was the matter.
"Nothing at all. Would you like another drink?"
"Not right now."
"What are your plans?"
"I still have to find the thief."
"What about your Russian friends?"
"I suppose they're still around."
"And they want you dead."
Dane nodded. Susan said,
"It's all so infantile. It's like little boys playing with guns."
"Do you really think it's like that?" Dane asked.
"Of course it is."
But she had a sudden terrible feeling that she was talking about something she knew nothing about. "In what way?"
"Just look at yourself, running all over Europe, getting shot at, shooting at people."
"What would you have instead?"
"A little common sense."
"How would you implement it?"
"Well, that's not up to me. That's up to people like you."
"If I could think of a better way," Dane said, "I'd do it."
"Would you really? Don't you think you'd feel lost without your trusty six-shooter?"
She heard herself with horror. She was the one who sounded like a child now. But she couldn't stop.
"Wouldn't you be naked without all the paraphernalia?"
"No, why should I be?"
"To hell with it,"
she said wearily. "We'll talk about it sometime," Dane said. "Right now, there's the problem of the thief."
"For you, not for me."
He looked at her questioningly. She was glad to see that she had startled him. For the first time, he looked unsure of himself. "What do you mean?"
"I mean I've had enough. I'm through chasing around Europe after some mysterious papers. It's simply all too silly."
"I can't force you."
"Of course you can't."
She loathed him now. He was saying all the wrong things.
"I want to go south to Italy or Greece. I want some sunlight."
Dane nodded. "Will you act as witness if and when we catch the man?"
"I suppose so."
There was nothing more to say after that. Dane finished his drink and left, wishing her a good trip. She was furious at him for his lack of perception, at herself for her inevitable ability to destroy what she wanted. How had it started? Why had she done it? She had no idea. It was another riddle for her analyst to explore and classify. It was almost noon. Dane took a taxi to a new building on Schwarzenbergplatz, where the American intelligence services had their offices. A special agent named Haynes was waiting for him. Haynes had all the available information on the thief carefully collated and arranged by time sequence and order of probability. Dane removed his coat and went to work. All the NATO countries had been affected to some extent by the loss of the American plans. Therefore, as a matter of course, each of them had assigned men to the case. The reports of these men were often colorful, but yielded no positive information. Previous rumors of the thief being seen in Beirut, Rome, and Athens had been followed up by the Central Intelligence Agency. The results so far were negative. Army intelligence, in cooperation with French and West German agents, was following a news story of the thief being seen and wounded in Istanbul. There were no results on that yet, but the outlook was dubious. There was a British report that a man answering the thief's description had been seen in Hong Kong. This was put aside as unlikely. An attempt had been made to tail known Soviet agents in Vienna, but it had proved unsuccessful. Too many of the agents of East and West knew each other's faces. Dane studied the carefully amassed collection of hopes, dreams, and guesswork for an hour, then gave it back to Haynes. Before he left, he was told that Colonel Nestor of Army Intelligence would like to see him. Nestor seemed subdued, perhaps depressed. Remembering their last conversation, Dane asked him if he had called Washington.
"As a matter of fact, I did," Nestor said. "Not to complain about you, I might add. I just wanted a more clear-cut directive."
"Did you get it?"
"They told me to get those papers back in any way I could, but to make sure I got them back. And they told me to cooperate with you to the best of my ability."
"Well, that was very nice of them," Dane said.
"You've got some good friends in Washington," Nestor said gloomily. "I wish I could say the same for myself. It doesn't matter, though. Washington says we have to get those damn papers back. They don't seem to realize it isn't as simple as that."
Dane nodded. He realized that he was watching the slow metamorphosis of a soldier into an intelligence officer.
"Do you have any ideas?"
Nestor asked. "Not one."
"No, I don't either. I'll be damned if I can think of anything else to do."
"We'll have to wait," Dane said. "There just isn't anything to do at the moment."
"I suppose not,"
Nestor said doubtfully. He got up and paced slowly across the room.
"You were in the army, weren't you, Dane?"
"The Office of Strategic Services."
"Well, that was a branch of the army,"
Nestor paced, chewing thoughtfully on his lower lip.
"Do you know I've been thinking of transferring back to the infantry when this case is over?"
"Why?"
"I'm really starting to think this branch of the service isn't for me."
"I think you're wrong," Dane said. Colonel Nestor stopped pacing.
"What do you mean?"
"You want to be where the fighting is. Today, most of the fighting is here."
Nestor thought about that. He said, "That's true enough, and I thought I could do a good job in intelligence, get some organization into it, get some guts into it, but I don't know."
"It needs all of that," Dane said, "but it also needs a great deal of patience and flexibility."
"Those aren't exactly my strong points."
"Oh, don't be too sure," Dane said. "Your superiors must have thought about that before they put you in here." For the first time, Nestor looked cheerful.
"Dane, that shows how very damn little you know about the army. Still, we'll see, we'll see. What are you going to do now?"
"Go back to my hotel and wait for something to happen." It was a mark of Colonel Nestor's powers of adaption that he was able to keep his temper. After a moment, he said,
"Yes, I guess that's best for now."
End of chapter 19. Chapter 20 of Dead Run by Robert Sheckley. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 20. Carlos walked down Wolfersgasse and stopped near the Vienna Opera House. His briefcase was tucked tightly under his arm. A sightseeing bus had parked nearby, and a thin, sad-eyed man was addressing a group of tourists. Carlos walked past them and came to a fluorescent hole in the ground, which spewed people out by escalator. A sign above the entrance read Orpen Passage. He rode the escalator down and looked carefully around the arcade beneath the street. He had picked this place himself. There were 6 exits from the Orpen Passage, and a circular restaurant in its center. Shops lined the outer wall, and the place always seemed to be crowded. From his limited knowledge of Vienna, he had been unable to find a safer or better place for the meeting. He circled the glass-fronted restaurant, staying near the outer wall of the arcade. Now he wished he had chosen a meeting place outdoors in the air, in a park perhaps, but that would have been too dangerous. It was better to do the business here, in this crowded underground place with too many people and stale air. When it was completed, he could have a lifetime of air, his own air. There would be a solid column of air rising above his own land. There was the man he was supposed to meet. He was sitting at a little table inside the restaurant, wearing a white carnation as Carlos had insisted. He was young and handsome, and he looked like an undertaker with his white-carved face rising above a dark necktie. Another man sat at the table with him, an older man, round-faced, with very good posture. That was all right. That had been agreed on, too. The older man carried a small black satchel. So far, everything was fine, except that he was doing the business himself instead of the drunken Klaus. Carlos looked at the tables near them. He saw two teenage boys and a girl drinking coffee and arguing. Just past them, a bearded young man with a knapsack on his shoulders was nodding to sleep over a glass of beer. On the other side, two men sat at different tables and read newspapers. One of them looked like a truck driver. The other was old and well-dressed and carried a tightly rolled umbrella. Everything seemed all right. Carlos entered the restaurant and sat down opposite the man with the carnation.
"The seat is not occupied?"
he asked. "Not for another half hour," the man with the carnation answered. That was correct. Carlos had been told about passwords by Anna, and he had insisted on having one. Now he knew that these were the right men. A waitress came over and both men ordered coffee. Carlos also ordered coffee. He was surprised to find that his heart was racing. The two men looked calm and slightly bored, as was proper for the representatives of a great power. They probably bought secrets often. It must be a regular business with them. A regular business. He had the feeling that this might turn out all right. Important men either do business with you or refuse immediately. These Russians were surely too rich and important to bother trying to steal back the secrets without paying. But if they did try, he was ready for them. "Have you brought the papers?" the young man asked. Carlos nodded.
"The money?"
"Of course." The older man tapped the black satchel. He looked as though something amused him, and Carlos decided at once that he didn't like that man. He wasn't going about this in a serious, business-like way like his friend with the carnation.
"Shall we exchange?"
"Yes," Carlos said.
He passed over his briefcase and received the black satchel. He opened it. There was nothing inside but packaged strips of newspaper. The young man with the carnation was glaring at him across the table. He had put down the briefcase after a quick look at the blank sheets of paper inside. The older man was smiling.
"What is this?"
the young man with the carnation asked. He sounded genuinely indignant. Carlos shrugged.
"I did not bring the papers. You did not bring the money."
The young man tried hard to control his temper.
"Obviously, we must see the papers first before we can pay. How did we know you wouldn't run away with the money and leave us with nothing?"
"Oh, that was exactly my problem,"
Carlos said sadly. He felt resigned to difficulties now. Business was very hard without trust.
"My friend has the money on his person. We are still prepared to pay. Where are the papers?"
Carlos gave him a broad grin.
"In a safe place."
"You have them with you?"
"Of course not. Pay me and I'll bring you the papers."
The young man shook his head.
"How can we trust you?"
"There is no other way," Carlos said. "You are men of a great government. You have many soldiers, much influence all over the world. I have only me, so you must trust me if you want the papers. I promise that as soon as you pay me..."
"No, we will go get the papers now."
Carlos glanced down, following the direction of the young man's eyes. He saw that the older, smiling man was holding a little gun in his lap. The gun had a curious barrel.
"It is silenced," the young man said. "Don't act foolishly. We are prepared to shoot."
Carlos looked at the older man. Yes, that man was certainly prepared to shoot.
"There would be no more than a click," said the young man. "You would double over with a pain in your stomach. We, your friends, would assist you outside. It would be very easy."
"Yes,"
Carlos said.
"Will you tell us where you have hidden the papers?"
"If I do, will you pay me?"
"Of course."
Carlos knew that the young man lied. He made a gesture of resignation.
"Then I will have to trust you."
"Where are the papers?"
"I will take you there."
The older man didn't like that idea. He seemed ready to argue the point, but the young man shook his head. They stood up. The older man had the little gun concealed in the folds of his raincoat. The young man paid, and they started out the door. As they passed, the bearded man with the knapsack woke up abruptly. Carlos stopped.
"I have left my briefcase."
"You won't need it."
"I will. Without it, I won't be able to find where I put the papers."
While they were thinking about that, Carlos took three steps back into the restaurant and picked up his briefcase.
"Thank you," he said.
The knife in his sleeve slid into the palm of his hand. He turned and flung the knife at the older man's heart. The man was amazingly agile. He started to move as Carlos's arm went back. The knife caught him solidly in the left shoulder, too high for a fatal wound. Carlos followed the knife with himself. He burst through the men at the door and ran toward the nearest exit. Behind him, he heard a woman scream. Then he was at the top of the escalator and hurrying into the crowds along the Opern Ring. The police arrived at the restaurant in the open passage with amazing promptness. Fortunately, as it turned out, for the foreigners seemed to have an almost morbid dread of publicity. They didn't even want to press charges at first. But as the policeman pointed out, a knifing in Vienna in broad daylight simply couldn't be ignored. The man who could commit such a crime had to be extremely dangerous. For the public good, it was necessary for anyone who had observed the knifing to bear witness. The foreigners, Russians, as he found out, saw his point at once, but perhaps matters like this were handled differently in Russia, for these men wished merely to make a short statement and be gone. That, of course, could not be allowed. The policeman was slow and thorough. He wrote down their names and addresses in his notebook, examined their passports, and then asked for an account of the crime. The older man, Herr Bardif, gave it. Holding a bloody handkerchief to his shoulder, Bardif explained that the man had asked permission to occupy the empty chair at their table. They had let him. He had sat down and almost immediately had tried to pick a fight.
"Without provocation?" the policeman asked.
"None that we were aware of," Bardif said. "I think the man was slightly out of his head. He wanted to argue politics."
"And then?"
"We rose to leave. We did not care to discuss politics. The man muttered some abuse, then quite unexpectedly he threw this knife."
Bardif handed the policeman a bone-handled spring-blade knife. The policeman said,
"You should not have handled it, sir. We might have recovered fingerprints."
"Forgive me," Bardif said. "I found it uncomfortable in my shoulder."
"Of course, I beg your pardon," the policeman scribbled hastily in his notebook. "Would you be so kind as to give me a description of the assailant?"
"He was of average height, dark-haired, tanned. He had a mustache."
"No, he didn't,"
a middle-aged American woman said from the crowd. She stepped forward, her handbag clenched firmly in both hands.
"I saw the whole thing. As a matter of fact, I screamed."
"Did you see the assailant's face?"
"I certainly did. He practically ran over me."
"What did he look like?"
"Well, he didn't have any mustache, and he was very short."
"Ridiculous," Zettner said. "We were at the same table with the man. He had a mustache."
"He didn't."
A young man with a knapsack on his back came forward.
"I saw the man, too, and I was at the next table."
"Did he have a mustache?"
"Oh, yes, and I would say he was well above medium height."
"You couldn't have really looked,"
the woman said.
"Are there any other witnesses?"
the policeman asked. No one in the crowd answered. An old man with a rolled umbrella cleared his throat explosively, but did not step forward.
"All right," the policeman said. "I request you four to come with me to this station house and make a full statement."
The woman looked indignant.
"But I've already made my statement."
"It's true," Bardif murmured. "We really have nothing more to add."
"I'm sorry, it is the law," the policeman said. "There must be an official statement made up and typed, then signed by each of you. Come, you wouldn't want a maniac to be running around loose."
"Of course not," Bardif said. "I will join you at the station house as soon as I've had my wound attended to."
"You must have the kindness to permit our police surgeon to do that."
"It isn't necessary. We have our own doctor in the embassy."
"But your embassy is a long way from here," the policeman said. "The station house is less than a block away."
Zettner said, "Officer, I will appear at the station house in 2 hours. I have some very important business to take care of first."
"So do I,"
said the man with the knapsack. The policeman shook his head. He was used to this sort of behavior from witnesses.
"No," he said. "We must go right now. You will be detained only an hour."
"An hour may ruin my business," Zettner said, almost to himself.
By now, 3 more policemen had come into the open passage.
"I think it will be all right," Bardif said, bowing to the inevitable. "Besides, it would be unnatural for us not to make an official statement."
"Exactly," the policeman said, "and perhaps it will take less than an hour."
He led his 4 witnesses to an exit. The well-dressed old man with the rolled umbrella watched them for a moment, then went to a different exit. The crowd slowly began to break up. End of chapter 20.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.